Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we have an amazing show. I am bringing Annie Jacobson to the program. She is a Pulitzer Prize finalist for her recent book. And she's an investigative journalist that looks into the military and the CIA and everything that's going on with the Department of Defense. Her books are absolutely riveting, but her current book is on paranormal and phenomena. Phenomena is the name of the book. And she dives into how the programs in the CIA and the Department of Defense evolved, where it started from the history, starting from the Nazis all the way to present day. And we dive into all that, and there are some bombshell revelations that she comes forward with in the book and some of the stuff in this interview today. So something that you want to listen to. This is a two-part interview, and this is the first part, and the second part will be airing on Friday on the Global Star Satellite. But I also want to tell you that her book is available at all places that fine books are sold and on her website at anniejacobson.com. But she's going to be at a book signing tonight at the Harvard Book Club for anybody who wants to go see her there. But I want to dive right into this interview because it's so riveting. So let's start that interview now. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I am excited to have you because you just put out a new book called Phenomena, and it is so dense and so interesting. And it's about the government's role in understanding the paranormal and how they went about trying to apply it. What motivated you to write this book?
Well, you know, all of my books so far, I get the spark of them in and I working on the previous book. So in this book, I was working on the Pentagon's brain about hard science at the Defense Department, about DARPA, looking through the Apollo Image Library, and I came across a photograph of an astronaut standing on the moon reading a document. And I thought, oh my God, what an amazing image. Here you have advanced science meets proto-science, you know, the earliest form of science, the tool that in essence created the whole scientific revolution, which is writing. And so I tracked the astronaut down. It was Edgar Mitchell. He was on Apollo 14. I asked him what he was reading on the moon, and he said he was reading a map. And the reason he was reading a map on the moon was because the astronauts had gotten lost locally. So it was this incredible thing to think about, that they had traveled a quarter of a million miles to get to the moon, landed within 87 feet of the target, and then got lost locally.
They had to use a map.
I mean, it was just unbelievable. And it sort of, it spoke of two things, of how human we are and how all this advanced science is created with our human brains. And yet all the same problems that plague us now, like getting lost, remain the same. And I knew from interviewing Mitchell that he was interested in ESP and that he had conducted ESP experiments on the way to and from the moon. And then he told me that his organization, when he got back from the moon, worked as a front for the CIA's early ESP programs. And I thought, that's my next book, Phenomena.
Well, when did the information actually come out that he was working with the CIA on this stuff? Just recently,
I don't know that it's really been fully disclosed until my book, because I filed a FOIA request, the Freedom of Information Act, and got the documents that Mitchell wrote with another colleague of his named Andrea Puharik, proposing one of the early psychic programs involving Uri Geller. And I don't believe that those had been released before. So it's certainly been known that Ed Mitchell was a, you know, fan of the paranormal, if you will. But I don't believe the details of his involvement in the CIA program have been reported before.
Wow, this is really interesting. So what other research did you do to back this book? I know you talked to a lot of people.
Well, it's always important to me to interview the scientists who work on the original programs. That's how I put piece together all of my books to begin with. In this case, I also interviewed the retired government psychics, or in some case, not retired government psychics. And then once you begin that journey, it's pulling documents through the FOIA requests to, you know, be able to double source the information and build the story and kind of begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
So you started the book looking at history, and you started with looking at the Nazis, and in particular Himmler. And Himmler and Adolf Hitler had a difference in opinion on this whole phenomenon. Can you give us a background on how the Nazis started and how they come into the picture in the very, very early days?
You bet. And I mean, isn't it? I'm so glad you hit upon this because it's so interesting to me, being a reporter, a national security reporter who looks at war and weapons from a historical standpoint. Everything seems to lead back to the Nazis. And that's because they had the most advanced science and technology programs during the war. And so immediately after the war, at the end of the war, before the treaty had been signed, before the Nazis had surrendered, we sent intelligence collection agents across Europe to try and locate what the Nazis were up to, their science, their technology, and ultimately the Nazis scientists themselves. Well, that's when we found this cache of documents called Das Annenerbe. That was Himmler's science organization. And one of his departments dealt with this area, extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, map dowsing. Himmler was into astrology. I mean, all kinds of ideas that we associate with the supernatural, with the occult. But the real rub was we got half these documents. Guess who got the other half? The Soviets. And so that set off the psychic arms race, because at the end of the war was exactly where the Cold War began, the new war against the Soviets. And we, the Americans, had to be able to, you know, lead in that science and technology. And that's where the programs began. That's also where the stigma, I believe, comes from, because this was, you know, Himmler's pseudoscience, if you will.
Well, I know that in Project Paperclip, we brought the Nazi scientists over, right? And and the Soviets got a bunch of them as well. Did we get more of the scientists working in this area, or did the Soviets?
Well, my second book was Operation Paperclip, which deals with exactly this morally complicated subject. We brought as many as 1,600 Nazis to the United States after the war to work on our weapons programs. The Soviets brought, we don't know the exact numbers, but it's a safe bet that they got about the same. But what's interesting is, as far as I know, and again, this is what we know now, I did not locate any of the scientists working in the supernatural, in the occult, that we brought here. Whether or not we actually did is unknown, but that is not, we just got the documents and began looking them. What we did do was recruit some individuals out of British intelligence, because the British were using, they were running black propaganda campaigns during the war against the Nazis, using the Nazis' belief in astrology, in divination, in premonition against them by inserting, you know, fake news, if you will, into their hierarchy.
And it worked, right?
Well, it was remarkable. I mean, the whole story of Hess, Rudolf Hess, who was the number two in the Reich, in 1941, before we had entered the war, Hess defected to England. He flew to England and crashed his plane there. And he did so, he later said, when he was in prison, on the advice of an astrologer. So you can see how entrenched they were. But, you know, going back to your original question, Hitler hated all of this, which is kind of ironic. So many of the top Nazis believed in this work and were sort of fascinated, moving toward obsessed with it. And yet Hitler, of all people, hated it. And there's a great quote when he tells Albert Speer, his defense minister, in one of the books Speer wrote after the war in prison. According to him, Hitler said, like, why can't we get rid of all this nonsense? You know, if only we had just stayed with the church. So when Hess defected to England, or tried to defect to England, Hitler took it upon himself as an opportunity to declare all things supernatural illegal. And he laid down this law called Special Action Hess, and he rounded up all the astrologers and supernaturalists in Germany during the war, and he put them in concentration camps.
Wow. Well, wasn't the Aryan race concept, wasn't the kernel of that started because of the supernatural belief?
Absolutely. That was Himmler's pseudoscience idea, that he could prove, this is what he was after, according to these documents captured by Operation Alsace, our intelligence unit. Himmler was trying to prove his theory of the Übermensch, the Superman, as opposed to the Untermensch, which was the, you know, subhuman. And the Übermann, the good German, the Aryan German, he believed, descended from this sort of weirdo, made-up Teutonic race, some quasi-white race that he believed existed in antiquity. And he was using archaeological digs and, you know, all things supernatural quests, if you will, to try and find this. Like, for example, he would send SS officers across the globe in search of these quasi-mystical ideas like the spear of destiny, which was said to pierce, you know, Christ when he was hanging on the cross, and the Ark of the Covenant. So, you know, it's not just from the movies. This we know from these declassified documents, which I located at the National Archives. This was really real stuff, according to the Nazis.
They really did it. But now Hitler didn't believe in it, but yet he believed in the Aryan race concept.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they were kind of pulling at straws. And again, that's where so much of the stigma comes from, because there was research organizations within the Reich. And then there was, you know, the shorthand version of it. I say this is so because I say it is so.
Okay. Well, it would be interesting to know whether the Soviets got some of these scientists, you know, that were actually working on that. You're just not going to know all this stuff looking at the documents, because we don't have access to all their stuff. But in your book, you talked about the first project the CIA worked on was a truth serum. And the project was coined Bluebird, and then it was changed to Artichoke, and then ultimately MK Ultra, which a lot of people know about or have heard. Can you describe what this project entailed?
You bet. And you know, I'm so glad you picked up on this, because so many of the sort of nefarious conspiracies that exist swirl around MK Ultra, because it was a very problematic and sometimes nefarious program, made even more complicated by the fact that in the 1970s, when this program came to light, the CIA quickly began destroying a lot of the documentation. So it was a real coup, I think, to be able to locate some of these MK Ultra program documents that for the book phenomena that have to do with this program you're talking about, which was an idea that the CIA was pursuing, that they could not only see the truth serum idea was one psychopharmacological program, that's a fancy word for drugs, but another idea that involved drugs, it involved hallucinogenic mushrooms. And in the early 1950s, hallucinogenic mushrooms did not exist. I mean, certainly they existed out in nature, but they were not known to anyone in America yet. It would be another decade before that would happen. But the myth that the CIA was chasing was an Aztec legend that if you gave these shamans, men who already had the gift, allegedly, of premonition, of divination, if you gave them these hallucinogenic mushrooms, that power would be enhanced. So they would be able to tell you the future, or, as it says in these declassified CIA documents, they'd be able to tell you who stole your lost donkey. So you can see the intelligence collection, you know, range here that the CIA thought and wanted to pursue, and sent scientists undercover into the wilds of Mexico in search of these hallucinogenic mushrooms.
But they did find them, right? And shamans, there's a lot of information out there now saying that these things really do some kind of remarkable thing. What did they ultimately find?
You know, off your comment about that, I will remind you of what President Ronald Reagan said, jumping forward for a quick moment here, decades later, when it was revealed that he was a proponent of this kind of, thinking that divination, that seeing the future was possible. But he said, you know, and he was kind of referring to the Bible, to biblical text, he said, "We know such people have existed through the years." So yes, they were working with an idea that has been around forever, that certain gifted people can know the future. And this really sparked inside of CIA, now we're back in the 50s, this pursuit would get bifurcated. It would get split into two paths. And this is important as it moved through the next decades into the Defense Department. The CIA began researching two questions. Is it biological? Is it something within? And the way that the CIA scientists explained this to me was they said, think of the, you know, music metaphor. So I can't sing in the shower. And then you think of what Mozart was capable and the music he created. And you think of me as a normal. And you think of Mozart as what CIA scientists called a supernormal. Not necessarily a paranormal, but a supernormal. So the two ideas at CIA at this time were, is it biological? Is this a gift from within? Some kind of enhanced knowledge? Or is it from without? And if you follow the line of research that says it's from without, that's where you get into the supernatural.
Well, and this mushroom that the shamans use, people talk about out-of-body experiences and just weird experiences that they have that is very unique when you have this mushroom that's different than other psychedelic drugs. And they started seeing that as well, right? And they were doing things with it.
Again, yes, absolutely. This was this idea of enhanced perception. And think about the famous Aldous Huxley book, The Doors of Perception. Well, I was surprised when I found these documents at the Library of Congress, inside the papers of Marcella DuPont. I was shocked to learn that the DuPonts and the Astors, the Forbes, these extremely wealthy families of the 1940s and 50s were actually co-financing some of the more out there work alongside the scientists who were working for CIA and the Army Chemical Center in these drug programs. And what they were looking on, so Huxley, Aldous Huxley himself, the author of The Doors of Perception, worked on one of these experiments whereby they gave a known psychic hallucinogenic mushrooms. And I even saw the logs that the doctor would write down about what was happening, because they thought, if we give this person who already has psychic functioning, who can successfully do these kind of mental telepathy tests that had passed some kind of laboratory muster, then perhaps we can enhance his perception. But it all went very wrong, because the lead doctor involved, a fellow by the name of Andrea Puharic, whereas he began as a sort of straight and narrow medical doctor on a quest, he began taking the mushrooms himself. And he really ended up going way too far down the road of the supernatural. And he becomes, in the book, a very cautionary tale of, you know, pursuing something to the gates of hell.
Well, he had a theory, right? That what was his theory that became so important at the beginning, which got the Astors involved and other very, very wealthy people?
So in the 1940s, he was this young, very handsome, very capable, charismatic medical doctor who was fascinated by ESP from his own experience that he once had with a dog. He said, you know, it's interesting how these conversion events, I call them, that happen in a man's life can then affect the trajectory of their work. So when he was young, he was very poor, grew up in the Chicago slums, and he said that he was a milk delivery boy, and he got cornered by a dog that was so dangerous, he felt the dog was going to kill him. And he kind of stared down the dog and began talking to the dog, according to Puharich. And the dog backed off. And this became a lifelong fascination to him, that you could somehow communicate with another animal. And, you know, later he would move this over to humans, but that he communicated with his dog through a means other than the five known senses. And that was his original pursuit. And he felt, as a medical doctor in the 40s, that he was going to pursue this idea that this was somehow something internal. He wasn't sure if it had to do with the body's electrical system, if it had to do with the physiology of the brain, but he was on a quest to know how, and that's how he got all of these wealthy Americans interested. He was lecturing at Harvard, at Yale, but again, he became very involved and interested in the drugs himself and really took things to an extreme.
Well, he might have been addicted, right? He got like a... Go ahead.
He would write, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he would, who knows if you can become addicted to hallucinogenic mushrooms, but certainly psychologically you can come to rely on them. And that's what he did. And again, we see these in these fascinating letters that I uncovered at the Library of Congress, where Puharich, his foundation was called the Round Table Foundation. And he was writing to these wealthy benefactors, and they were participating in these seances and these palm readings. I mean, they were really pursuing the supernatural aspects of this. And at the same time, he had the Defense Department hiring him to work at the Army Chemical Center to work on the psychopharmacological elements of the program.
They didn't know how far he was going on the other side, though, right? They thought he still had this image as a really straight and narrow scientist that was diving into some of these things, because Tesla was, people were trying to figure out what waves, like we had some wave or that we could communicate on, and they're trying to figure out where that was in the spectrum.
You're absolutely right. They, for a while, they were pursuing this idea of whether or not it was a kind of mental radio. And Tesla was a great inspiration to many of these working on the program, because Tesla himself wrote in his memoirs about his early experiences with ESP. And what's interesting is when you think of Tesla as kind of the progenitor of wireless technology, certainly in terms of conception, these are ideas that Tesla modeled after his own experiences with ESP. So it was kind of a free-for-all. But no, I don't believe that, from looking at the documents, that the Army was aware of how far Puharich was into this work. And very quickly, when they wouldn't allow him to push the science further, he retired. And then he went civilian, and then he kind of went rogue. But he pops up again and again. And in the 1970s, when the CIA gets involved in the work, there's Puharich again, working with Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut. By then, he had somewhat of a sordid reputation. And in declassified documents from the 1970s, CIA folios, you can see them kind of saying things, and I'm paraphrasing, like, we got to get rid of the Puharich guy. He brings a lot of baggage to the program. And they kind of eased him out. They paid him through, a sort of third party, so that there was no trace that they were working with Dr. Andrea Puharich.
Well, and Edgar Mitchell got involved with him too, right? Because when he went on his up to the moon, he actually conducted a secret ESP experiment.
That's right. That's right. So and Edgar Mitchell.
Go ahead. Sorry. No, you go ahead.
Well, Mitchell was inclined. He was a great explorer, you know, and I loved interviewing Mitchell. And if you read through the 1,000 pages of transcripts of the Apollo 14 mission, or if you read my narrative version of it in the book in one of the chapters, you know, it's remarkable, the human physiology, the extraordinary, almost supernatural feat of the Apollo astronauts on the 14, because they had a lot of problems, all of which were kind of covered up, because remember, Apollo 14 came right after Apollo 13.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had the word from NASA, like, you must make this look like it's all smooth. So this extraordinary human functioning, that's what they called it. You know, what Mitchell and the other astronauts did on the moon was remarkable. And yet Mitchell conducts these ESP experiments and then spends the rest of his life suffering from that. I mean, he was ridiculed for decades until his recent death about these experiments. No one paid any attention to the remarkable human feats. And it seemed to me quite tragic that no one paid attention to the fact that Mitchell was really interested in the idea of the far reaches of knowledge. The idea of, you know, if the human body is capable of being an astronaut on the moon, and if the human mind was capable of getting man to the moon, what else are we capable of? But, you know, ESP is a dirty word in the science community, and he was ridiculed.
Now, that's too bad, because you shouldn't ridicule someone for just doing an experiment and seeing where these things land. But he followed his passions, right? And then decided to go work on this.
Yes, he had, again, a conversion moment on the way home from the moon. That's the way he described it to me in our interviews. He was looking out one of the windows of the five windows of the spacecraft. And he said he looked into the, you know, into space, into the universe, at the stars. And he thought to himself, my God, I'm paraphrasing Edgar Mitchell, man is more than just what we presently know. And he became overwhelmed with this idea, he said, that man was connected to the cosmos in ways that were very significant and that were not yet known. That was the idea of consciousness. And he absolutely vowed in that moment, he said, to come home and dedicate his life to those pursuits. When he came home, he quit NASA. He divorced his wife. He got all new friends. I mean, he was a scientist with a PhD from MIT, and suddenly he rejected all of that, and he became involved in the world of the pursuits to try and determine whether extrasensory perception was fact or fantasy. And he did spend the rest of his life doing that.
And was he ever respected for it? I know he is in circles, right? And maybe history, he will ultimately be the most respected. But amongst scientists of today and of his era, was he ever, you know, given respect for that?
No, quite the opposite. I mean, every article about Mitchell, you know, kind of had a snickering journalist ridiculing these ESP experiments. And, you know, it kind of led to, if you will, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Another theme I write about in the book, because there's lots of arguments for ESP and whether or not this is fact or fantasy. I try to, as the journalist, write neutrally and present all these different sides and let the reader decide what they think. But the self-fulfilling prophecy for Mitchell was like they were saying, you know, in essence, he's a loose cannon. And his life took very dark turns. He had problems with money. He had problems with women. He had a son out of wedlock that he said wasn't his son. Remember, this is back in a much more conservative era, and the press went crazy on that. They really hounded him, and it became a bit of a dark path for Mitchell. And not only was he sort of rarely revered or given credit for the extraordinary feats on the moon, which I don't think also were really ever reported before in, you know, long form, right? What I write in the book and the chapters is some of these moments that they had on the moon that were terrifying were just stunning to me to learn them from the transcripts. But and then in the later years of Mitchell's life, he got very involved in the UFO community, in the community that spends quite a bit of time talking about, you know, alien visitations. And this, again, led to journalists really hounding him for his ideas.
Well, any scientist in history that changes the paradigm is ridiculed. It's just the way it is. And so if you're different, you're going to be ridiculed. And it's too bad, because people who are publicly bullied in that way and laughed at, they can be so affected by, we're connected somehow, and it hurts people to a whole nother level. And I could see how that dark kind of could come in. But he's such an amazing person. It's when you study him. I want to move on a little bit and maybe we can get back to him, but you also talked about a few really, really talented people in this area, and one of them being Geller. Can you explain what his talents were and how the CIA tried to involve him?
Well, Geller is such an enigmatic and energetic character. And interestingly, he does tie into Mitchell and that last comment you made about, perception. Because whereas Mitchell was ridiculed and sort of wasn't able to hold up to, you know, really suffered for the way he was treated, Geller, on the other hand, seemed to be and remains bulletproof to all this. I mean, in the book, I write about the decades-long fight between the magician James Randi, who kind of has made it his life's mission to prove Geller is a fraud, and Geller, who has made it his life's mission to bend spoons for every person who comes across his path, and make an extraordinary amount of money map dowsing, which we haven't even talked about yet, which is fascinating, that idea that you can point to a map and locate oil or gold. And that's what Geller did on commission.
He was being paid, so he got it right a lot.
Absolutely, and this is after he retired. After Geller was a CIA asset in the 70s. He was extremely, famous within the public, and he just became too hot of a potato with all these skeptics wanting to derail him. And also, I learned from the CIA handlers who worked with him in the 70s that I interviewed for Phenomena, they feared Geller was a Mossad agent. And so Geller left into the private sector. He did some work for the FBI locating kidnapped people. And then he began to do this map dowsing. First of all, he started doing it for companies for his million-pound fee. He was living in England at the time. And then, as he told me, he decided to take a commission. And this was reported in Forbes magazine in the 80s, how incredibly wealthy he was becoming by working for these mining companies, pointing to a map, saying, this is where we should go. And then they would take Geller in a helicopter into these remote areas to the place he had pointed on a map, and they would give him a closer-up map, if you will, and he would point to there, and they would get closer and closer, and they would find what they were looking for, and Geller would participate financially. And so Geller has turned all of this into this. Not only has it not taken him down, but it's made him, I went to interview him in Israel, and he was by far the most famous person in Israel. I mean, people on the street stop him from around the world, recognize him, and ask him to bend a spoon, which he does for them graciously by pointing the tip of his finger at the spoon and shouting the sort of supernatural command, bend.
Did he do it for you when you went out there?
I saw him bend 25, 30, 35 spoons over the course of 4 days. And he bent, once when we were in a restaurant, the kitchen staff said, please, we just adore you. Will you come back into the kitchen? And he did a telepathy test for them. They all stopped cooking. And then he proceeded to bend with the tip of a finger a very large, cooking spoon that someone was stirring the soup with. I mean, I have seen the magician's spoon bending videos. Yes, it is a magician's trick that can be done with something called predigitation. But it didn't appear to me that that is what Geller was doing. I have no answer for it. I write about in the book more narratively that I hope the reader can then make their, conclusion or really think about what they think might be going on. Because, again, is it fact? Is it fiction? Is it science? Is it supernatural?
But what is causing it? Because you saw it. You saw it happen 25 times. Wasn't there a situation where he was on a radio show and then he did some experiment and it affected thousands of people across England?
I mean, this is why the CIA was watching him for decades, not just when he was originally working there, but because, absolutely, I mean, he would do these shows and command children across, countries, across continents to bend whatever they had in front of them. And then the mothers would write into the newspapers with photographs saying, my child bent this spoon. And that speaks to the idea of, you know, the placebo effect. The idea that you could give someone a harmless pill and their physiology, yes, they would actually become better because of their belief system that they believe they took medicine that would make them well. So you see the mind over matter working in the individual human physiology. Again, super interesting to the CIA, super interesting to me. But the idea that Geller says is that children do not have the inhibitions that this kind of thing is possible because they just don't. I mean, the same way children are excellent artists, and then it kind of goes away. The way children are unafraid of singing. I mean, again, these are metaphors that CIA scientists use, and I think legitimately so, because it speaks to the bigger idea at issue, which is, what are the far reaches of knowledge? What is it that man is capable of? And how much time and treasure should we and do we spend researching this on a federal government level that has to do with intelligence collection and military assets?
Well, and one of the things that you just talked about is that, and it causes part of the problem, is that you have to believe in order for it to work. And like, it works so well in children because they don't have any of those issues. So if you don't believe, it probably won't work. And so that's part of it.
That is a great point. Yes. I mean, you hit the nail on the head with that one. You have to believe, which is that great, you know, line from the X-Files and that so many people gravitate toward.
And so that's part of the problem, right? We're getting over this hurdle of the science behind this. But once he went on the radio, it really sparked a lot of criticism. And you talked about this in your book with Carl Sagan, and his peers really had a hard reaction to this. Could you talk a bit about that?
They cited the Nazis. I mean, they said, this is dangerous. People who believe in the occult and the supernatural, that's all they would call it. They couldn't think about it as an advanced physiology, let's say. You know, they came down hard and said, this is dangerous and this leads to fascism. They actually said that. And when they found out that the Stanford Research Institute was conducting experiments, laboratory experiments for the CIA, they said, you know, Stanford should be shut down. I mean, they were outraged and incensed, and it led to the movement which continues today, the scientific skeptics movement. What I found very interesting, and I interviewed a number of the skeptics to get their side of the story, but the father of modern skepticism was a man named Martin Gardner, and he wrote kind of the original book on the subject called Fads and Fallacies, and he, you know, made fun of all these different, you know, very weird thoughts, you know, people talking about the earth was flat, and he put anything having to do with extrasensory perception into that category. Well, when I was speaking with skeptics, I learned an interesting piece of the puzzle that as a national security reporter I had not realized before, because I don't ever report on faith, okay? But what I learned was that a lot of the scientific skeptics call themselves atheist skeptics, okay? So any concept of God they are utterly intolerable of, because they consider God to be a supernatural being. Okay, which I hadn't really put those obvious things together, I must say. Mm-hmm. But when I realized that, it made sense why they take issue with any of this. If anyone says this comes from without, then in essence they are talking about, you know, God, let's say. But here's the remarkable thing. Martin Gardner, the father of the modern skeptics movement, had a conversion moment several years before his death, switched his position and said, I believe in a God, and I believe in an afterlife, and I can believe in him, and no one can tell me otherwise. And this drives his colleagues wild, and they don't like to discuss that because it was not widely reported, and I think they like to keep it that way. But it is an actual fact. Gardner did an interview with Cambridge University, and he did a series of interviews about his faith.
Interesting. So it would be embarrassing for them to have that, but how do they explain just the weirdness of some of the things? I mean, don't they ever in their life have any kind of unique connection with somebody?
Well, I think it goes back to the idea that you just spoke of. If you don't believe, if you absolutely will not and refuse to believe in anything other than the scientific method, then you are not going to have those experiences, or you're going to be able to explain them. For example, coincidences, you know, at one in a billion coincidences, you could explain using mathematics, and many of the skeptics do. But let's bring up an important point here for a brief second, which is it's important to realize that everything we're talking about, ESP, psychokinesis, map dowsing, none of it passes scientific method muster. And that is a valid point that the scientific skeptics do and should take. In other words, since the scientific revolution of 1500, everybody agrees that there are these five steps to the scientific method, and that you must pass all those steps, and then the experiment must be repeatable. That is the key. And when you're talking about phenomena, none of them are repeatable consistently. In other words, Geller can bend the spoon in front of me 25 times, or in front of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as he has, but he can't bend the spoon under pressure on Johnny Carson. So that's what the skeptics use as saying, aha, it's not science, it's fraud, because it isn't science, because it is not repeatable.
But you can explain, it is repeatable under the same conditions, just not when you bring in another factor. Which is
to them, that's not
fear
repeatable.
Or whatever.
They're, yes, and they say, so the scientists who are in the work call it fickle. And the scientific skeptics say hogwash.
Well, I think that you just have to be able to accept other factors that could go in. But I can see this, because we don't, when it comes in physics, for example, they know at the nuclear level that we affect the actual experiment. And Einstein found this, and other, you know, physicists found that when the scientist is actually in the room, we actually, the person is actually affecting the experiment, and the outcome of the experiment can be flawed just because the person's standing there.
Yes, and you're referring to a line of thinking pursued by a Nobel laureate theoretical physicist named Wolfgang Pauli, and it's called the Pauli effect. Pauli himself would go into laboratories, the lights would go off. He once went into the Princeton cyclotron, the room that held the cyclotron, and the cyclotron caught on fire. I mean, this was the Pauli effect, and it caused him to ask, do humans affect their environment? And he spent decades searching for the answer, you know, came up with nothing that could move toward general theory, but an extraordinary amount of interesting ideas in this subject. And I'm so glad that you picked up on that, because it's really it really kind of opens the mind to some new things to think about.
Well, the problem was, we just don't understand. You know, I mean, we can't shut it down because we don't understand it. We have to admit, okay, we don't understand. And sometimes science, there's so many different variables, and maybe you just have to expand the amount of variables you're allowed into your experiment. But go ahead.
Yes, I mean, you know, and it's open for great debate about this, but many of the scientists will tell you, you know, as a broad reference, and again, the skeptics go crazy about this, they say, look, you know, for 1,000 years, scientists pursued the idea, maybe the Earth isn't the center of the universe, because that was the long-standing scientific belief. And it took 1,000 years to move off that idea to the idea that we accept now, that the sun is the center of the universe. But that was a very long time of hypothesis to general theory. And scientists who are very pro-ESP and psychokinesis will cite that as an example.
Well, exactly. Now we're just on the edge of a solar system in the universe, in a smaller sun. But, okay, so I want to move on to a couple other people that you brought up in the book who are amazing, like Geller, but they work on remote viewing and other things, out-of-body experiences, Ingo Swann and Pat Price. Can you talk about what their capabilities are and how they got involved with the CIA?
Well, in the 1970s, the CIA began its sort of modern era program, and those researchers were working at the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, in Northern California. And it was the idea that the CIA was behind all of it was masked. But of course, there's these fascinating CIA documents where Pat Price, the psychic, is talking to his CIA handler, and he says, you know, I know you work for the CIA. You know, he was psychic. And, you know, they went kind of crazy over this. Like, how can he know? Well, how did Pat Price know anything he knew? I mean, Ingo Swann was another super psychic. So they were able to coin, the CIA scientist coined a term then called remote viewing, which was this idea that you could essentially travel out of your body and see something thousands of miles away. And this is completely unacceptable to scientific skeptics, understandably so. It doesn't make any sense. And yet the CIA was experiencing time and time again where the psychics, Swann and Price, would be able to garner information from either classified facilities back east. There's an amazing story I narrate in the book about a secret underground NSA facility that Pat Price is able to remotely view and literally pull code names off of files. He was able to pull the colonel's name tag off the desk, okay, and report them back to his CIA handlers in California. Well, the Defense Department went wild and conducted a security investigation against CIA, against Pat Price, saying, where's the KGB mole that you must have working for you? Because there's no way anyone could know this information. And, you know, ultimately, the investigation concluded that it wasn't a KGB mole because Pat Price continued to work for the agency. So the unknowable nature of all of this began to get spookier and spookier to the point where the CIA coined a term called the eight martini lunch. And that was to describe a situation where a CIA handler would be with one of these psychics. The information they would deliver was so remarkable, the analyst had to have eight martinis to kind of calm down and really kind of fathom the unfathomable.
Well, it's just so bizarre, right? You sound like a Fruit Loop when you start talking about these things, but then they found that on very, very rare occasions, there are people like this that can do it. And isn't that the point, is that they're so rare? There's some people that have a weak ability. There's a few that have, you know, a fairly strong, and then there's a few like these guys that are absolutely remarkable.
Exactly. And that was the CIA's conclusion, that it was somehow biological, but that it was most definitely what they called individualistic. Again, going back to that Mozart analogy. And so the CIA's position was, you need to focus on the Mozarts. You need to work with the Ingo Swann, the Pat Price, the people who are just born with this talent that no one can explain, and try and exploit that for maximum intelligence collection purposes. But, you know, the Defense Department looks at things very differently than the CIA. And when the Defense Department took over the program in the late 1970s, they took on a different approach. And as I write in the book, this became a whole new battleground, because the Defense Department decided, no, we're not going to go with this idea that it's individualistic. We're the Department of Defense, and we believe that all knowledge can be learned. Like, you can train to do anything. And so they created a program whereby they made a manual, and they had the famous super psychic from the CIA, Ingo Swann, work with them to create a so-called training manual. And then they set about working to train soldiers to be psychic.
Yeah, and how did that go? How did they end up, how did it work in the field, and how successful were they at being able to train? I mean, do you have to have a core of capability in the first place?
Well, it had very mixed results, and you've raised a very important question. And again, this is my read on it as a journalist, and, you know, many individuals in the program will tell you a different thing. They will tell you that they did successfully train psychics. That is not my interpretation, based on documents that I reviewed, declassified, and also exclusive interviews with the scientists who were leading the program, who in essence began to really focus on the information that was being given to them by the people in the program who said they were psychic. So it went like this. On the one hand, you had a group of soldiers who were being trained, said they, the qualifications were, you don't have to be psychic, we're going to train you to be psychic. And they were all working on training and then on some operations. And some of the results are just abysmally bad, right? And then on the other hand, you have a few individuals like a woman named Angela Della Fiora, whose story I tell for the first time in Phenomena. She actually was working at the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the kind of Defense Department CIA. She was an analyst writing, you know, reports on unrest in certain countries. Well, she really was psychic, according to her. She got wind of the psychic program, very classified, by the way. She got wind of it because she's psychic. And she went around the chain of command. She tracked down the general in charge of the program, and she said, you must put me on this program. I am psychic. And she did a reading for the general that so convinced her of her supernatural talents, if you will, that he put her on the program. Well, this created enormous discourse inside the program. Here you have this female civilian analyst who claims to be psychic, something that the soldiers who were training to be psychic found offensive because they were working really hard to try and prove that this was a trainable technique. And they did not like someone sort of saying that she was psychic because they felt that was occult-ish. It was supernatural, and they were trying to move away from that. But when you look at the documents, you see these remarkable success stories that Angela Della Fiora had. And, you know, one after the next, where she was able to locate hostages, locate, you know, in one point she was tasked to find, this is in the 80s now, Gaddafi was moving chemical weapons out of Tripoli somewhere else. And they used Angela Della Fiora to try and locate where the ship was with these chemical weapons, and she did. So with her getting all of the sort of successful hits, it created real tension inside the department because, you know, they felt it was a catch-22. They felt that she was getting all the good opportunities because she was being favored. And the scientists, you know, tell me that they were just going with the intelligence that was the most actionable.
Well, it proved again that what the CIA's conclusion was. And but did they find that you could take somebody who was psychic and make them more psychic, or that everybody might have some psychic abilities and so you could enhance that, but it takes that still that rare Mozart. Like, we can all learn to do music, right? But I will never become a Mozart.
Yes. And, you know, the idea of enhanced psychic functioning stopped, as far as I can tell, and certainly from my interviews with the psychics who worked on these programs. In the 70s, once it was revealed that the CIA, during what were called the Church Commission hearings, that the CIA had been giving drugs to people, to unwitting people. And so that all stopped. And I always asked the psychics, you know, and the scientists when I was interviewing them right off the bat, were there drugs involved, you know? And the answer was always no, because this went out of, you know, it became illegal. And so, but again, you're right. It speaks to this idea that the CIA was pursuing, that this enhanced perception is, in fact, biological. And one of the most remarkable things I found out in reporting and researching phenomena was that this is now back to where we are again today. The Defense Department is actually pursuing the idea that the sixth sense might be biological, and they're trying to learn from that.
Well, one thing that you talked in the book, which I want to get into a little bit with the Soviets again, Alan Dulles, in a famous speech about brain warfare, he says its aim is to condition the mind so that no longer reacts on free will or rational basis, but responds to impulses implanted from outside. And this kind of leads into some of the stuff the Soviets were doing with microwave beams directed at our soldiers in submarines. And they were worried about this, which is part of also the weapons, kind of why it went into the Department of Defense, I think. You can correct me. But can you tell us a little bit about that?
You're absolutely right. So during the early days of the Cold War, and let's say the 50s and then in the 60s, the CIA, while it was pursuing its research programs in ESP and psychokinesis, it was also watching what the Soviets were doing. And problems arose. I mean, the CIA really got freaked out when they began to realize through human intelligence, through, you know, spies looking at what the KGB was working on, that the Soviets had their scientists in the laboratory merging technology with their technology research with microwave beams and ESP. And at first, the CIA could not figure out what these two seemingly, you know, completely separate programs had to do with one another, but they fell under the same banner that the Soviets called psychoenergetic research or psychotronic research. And then when the intelligence community learned that the Soviets were beaming microwave signals at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, very high-powered frequency signals that ultimately were determined to cause cancer, they became so alarmed because they realized that what the Soviets were doing was trying to mess up, in essence, the thinking of U.S. personnel, including the ambassador. And this became an extraordinarily controversial classified counter program at DOD. The employees at the embassy were not told that they were the subject of these microwave beams. And instead, the Defense Department opened up its nefarious program called Project Pandora. And they began beaming microwave beams at primates, monkeys, at Johns Hopkins Laboratory to try to determine how this idea of psychotronics that the Soviets were pursuing merged with ESP. And, you know, their actual findings remained a great mystery for decades until you come to where we are today and you realize the Soviets were really onto something and that they were looking at trying to merge the enhanced psychic function with computer technology and modeling to see if they can't solve this age-old mystery. Is this fact or is this fantasy?
So now what did they come up with? I suppose we don't have the Soviets' research information, but what did we come up with that?
Well,
or do we not know? Is it still classified?
Well, in terms of the Moscow signal?
Yeah, in terms of what we've learned from microwave beams being directed into people's brains and how that affects their thinking, what did we learn from that?
Well, A, part of it is very classified, and B, the part that was unclassified revealed that this generation, by generating these high penetration microwave beams, you could cause cancer in humans. And three of the ambassadors, the ambassadors to the U.S. ambassadors to the Soviet Union, died because of this. So, and again, these were programs that we now know only recently the Nazis were originally working on. So.
Well, weren't they testing their cells to see what their reaction would be, but they didn't tell them?
Testing themselves, meaning were the Soviets testing their own individual?
No, not cells. Cells. Like, weren't they testing the participants, our participants, unwittingly, and they didn't know? Or am I thinking of another project?
No, our employees at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow were being essentially guinea pigs of the Soviet Union. We, the Americans, the CIA and the Defense Department, knew this was going on and neglected to tell the employees of the embassy that they were being penetrated by these beams. And instead, we set up a program at the embassy whereby we took everyone's blood there,
yes,
saying, you know, there was some kind of a virus going around and we just needed blood samples. So that really moves into the nefarious realm where you have the Defense Department knowing that its employees were under, you know, were in harm's way and not doing anything.
And that's all we have for today. I want to remind you that the second part of this interview will be playing on Friday, at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Global Star Satellite, and it will also be available shortly after on YouTube and 90-plus different streaming and podcast channels, as well as my website at sarahwestall.com. And, of course, if you can't wait that long, you can always get her book. It's all over the Internet and also at anniejacobson.com. This interview, if you want to hear it again or if you want to refer a friend to listen to it, it will be available on my website at sarahwestall.com, as well as over 160 now shows and articles there on my website. And it'll be available on YouTube shortly after it airs today. So for now, I want everybody to have an amazing day.